Well, who the guitar player is Nile Rodgers, right?
Yep.
But
and he's from the band Chic.
Chic, not Les Chic. Where am I getting Les Chic from?
From Le Freak, which is a song by Freak. Chic.
Les Chic.
Welcome to 80s Music Exposed, the podcast in which we review all the best albums of the 80s, one month at a time. We will break them down, give you the skinny, and duke it out over whether you should or should not dig these back out again. If you are ready for an 80s music deep dive, from Public Enemy to Wham, Eno to XTC, Madonna, hair metal, reggae, and all points in between, then crank the boombox, turn the Walkman up to 10, and ooh, let's go. Now, from the kitchen, Chris and Henry.
We have made it to the end of 1980.
Woo! Welcome to 80s Music Exposed. I'm Henry.
And I'm Chris.
And I'm Greg.
And I'm Megan.
We got the whole crew here.
The gang's all here.
Yeah, so we're all in the kitchen, sort of, at least sonically. We're all in the kitchen. Megan didn't want to drive down from Michigan. I can't imagine why.
The weather's pretty cold and shitty here right now, so yeah. I wouldn't mind, actually.
This is our end of the year. We've been from January to December.
Henry, a bit of housekeeping before we get to the show, because we got a lot to talk about. You wanted to talk about the passing of Rankin Roger.
He died on March the 27th, and he was only 56 years old, diagnosed with a brain tumor and lung cancer. It was only last year, so it must have been he got diagnosed in a precipitous slide, I guess.
Yeah, because I think he was working on something at the time. Like he was working on music at the time. It wasn't like he knew he was sick.
And I know we'll probably talk about this later, but that record that they did with the English Beat that I Just Can't Stop is probably one of the first records you and I listened to together. Do you remember that?
Oh yeah.
And your
How could I forget?
Yeah. And so I just thought that I kind of wanted to mark that time. I listened to a podcast that Dave Wakeling was on. It's one of those UK DJ guys that kind of talks, you know, like this. But
like an English person?
No, like a used car salesman. Like that. But he said that they expected it. And that they were 16 years old, you know, when they got together. And in the last, you know, years of his life, he was friendly and happy toward him, and they were loving and generous toward each other. So he said that he felt good with the way things kind of ended up, even though they'd had some falling outs, you know, over the years. But just wanted to mark this time, rest in peace, Rankin Roger, right?
Right, and how apropos, because we are talking, I think, about their best record, that which came out in 1980. So, this is our 1980 end-of-year episode. I'm going to do my best to try to moderate things so we can keep going through all the records that we liked from that year. So, let's start. I thought we'd just go around and mention everybody's top record from 1980. And, Megan, why don't you start us off?
By talking about Rankin Roger and, of course, the studio album I Just Can't Stop It, which is their first album. Like, it's a debut album, and they were very young. So, really impressive record. And personally, I think it's probably the epitome of like ska at its best, because I feel like ska over the years has kind of gotten almost like a little silly. And I like that this still has kind of like a new wave element to it. I pretty much, I like the English Beat, like everything they've done, but this is definitely like my favorite album of theirs. And it's just nuts that it was their first album.
Yeah.
And with Rankin Roger passing, you mentioned that, you know, he had been working on new music. I think he actually, I think he worked on like a brand new album, like pretty close to up until, you know, he passed away. And I think the cancer, it was pretty like aggressive, and it was, you know, in a far stage. So there wasn't too much they could do about it. But I was listening to Sirius XM around the time he passed away, and Dave Wakeland was on, I think, First Wave. And he was talking about Rankin Roger, and he kind of expressed the stuff that Henry mentioned. It was just nice to hear that they had kind of patched things up and they were both in a good place with each other. Of course, it's always sad when somebody passes away, but it was good that they at least, you know, were on good terms with each other, I think.
Yeah, my first memory of this record was actually the T-shirt that Sting wore in one of their videos.
Oh, really?
It was one of those.
Oh, yeah.
And it was one of those T-shirts, like, it was the first time I'd seen a T-shirt that I was like, I have to have the T-shirt, but I don't know what the band is.
But didn't it say The Beat?
Yeah, it said The Beat.
Not The English Beat?
Because they're not The English Beat over there. They're just The Beat. But I was like, oh, my God,
so
I got to find out about that band. Yeah. And also, I want to say, I agree with you, Megan, like, or maybe in my mind, I never really liked ska. But I never really thought of The Beat as ska until later. And I was like, yeah, I guess they are ska. But I was always like an anti-ska person, but I always loved The Beat.
You didn't like the cartoon ska stuff.
I didn't like Madness. I didn't like Madness. And maybe that's part of the silliness. And I wanted to like The Specials a lot, but I never really, really got into it.
Something about that one record, it wasn't over the top. It wasn't silly.
Oh, definitely. If you look at a band, like, this is later on, of course, but, like, Real Big Fish. I mean, I don't dislike them, but, like, I think that that's kind of, like, ska at the super silly, like, lots of dancing involved, which, I mean, dancing is fun, but I liked kind of the scaled back, a little bit more subtle, kind of. And I think The Clash, actually, you know, they incorporated, especially in Sandinista, which, you know, we recently talked about, there's definitely ska elements in that, too. So I don't know, like,
yeah,
I'm not saying that The English Beat, like, originated, you know, ska, but I think that they kind of took those elements that The Clash was kind of tinkering around with, too, and just built kind of a little bit of an, like, I mean, at least with them, I think they have a pretty unique sound.
Well, Henry, for your choice, I think we're going to go in a totally different direction than ska.
Yep. Chose Crazy Rhythms by the Feelies. And
good choice.
And it was a tough selection. I mean, I am privy to some of the things that you guys selected, so I had to look at it and say, of all the records that that I listened to in 1980, that was my favorite. For me, it sounded, I don't know, somebody let the nerds into play, right? You know? And it's kind of frenetic and anxious and a lot of nervous energy. And I think it's something that I identify with just as a person. But also, you could see its influence in people like R.E.M., Weezer even, you know, sort of co-opted that kind of for lack of a better word, nerdy delivery, I suppose. What did you guys think of the record?
I love this record, right. But I love the Feelies, and I think they kind of get forgotten a little bit.
I should put in a caveat. One of the, not the first rock show that I went to at 1313 in Charlotte, but one of the first maybe was the Feelies, and it was, gosh, I can't remember the name of the record. It was like their third or fourth.
Time for a Witness.
Is that the one?
I think so.
Or it was either that or after. But I remember Bill Million being up there, and he would play his guitar so fast and so hard and jump up and down that he would break strings left and right. You know, and he played a hollow body guitar, you know. Which all that really imprinted on my mind, you know.
The thing I'll take from that show too, and I don't know if it was part of the band in Crazy Rhythms, was they had two drummers.
Yeah,
and I had only ever experienced 38 Special having two drummers to that point, so it was kind of cool to see somebody that wasn't 38 Special have two drummers. So, Crazy Rhythms is Henry's choice. My top choice for the year is an album called Closer by Joy Division. I don't know what to say about it. It's like talking about Heavy Road or something.
Yeah, what are you?
Of course, Closer is on our list. And that's all. I don't know. I don't know. I have a lot to say about that. I think the funny thing is I actually came to Joy Division backwards from New Order. Mm-hmm. And I think going through the 80s, it's going to be funny how much I like New Order.
Mm-hmm.
And it's weird to see to find a band backwards. Where in my mind, I'm always like, "Well, New Order's my favorite, but they were the first." But no, they weren't. They were really. It's really backwards. But
I'm jealous that you picked this record to talk about because, like, I love Joy Division and I love New Order. I think I prefer New Order a little bit, but I feel like even if Ian Curtis had lived, I feel like they still kind of would have went maybe in a similar direction as, like, New Order ended up going.
You think so?
Totally. I think so. I mean, it would have been a little different, of course.
It's hard to see because, like, we've lived our life listening to Bernard Sumner sing a certain way. You know?
Yeah.
And then with Ian being dead, like, would he still be able to do that?
But it's also interesting, like, they didn't, in everything I've read about them, they didn't really go in the direction they went because they were trying to break from Joy Division. It is like they were already all interested in those sounds and that type of thing. He just happened to kill himself. It wasn't like they were like, okay, now we've got to come up with something completely different.
In fact, Ian Curtis was playing Kraftwerk records at the start of the gig, so they were already into the electronic stuff.
You're right.
I recently read Deborah Curtis. She wrote a book about, like, her life with Ian, which I recommend reading as you're, you know, a Joy Division fan. And then the movie Control as well. I don't know if you've ever seen that one, but it's pretty good.
Yeah, I think her book's Touching from a Distance. That's a great book. Yeah,
it is.
And so Closer, I think, is more than just my pick, but I stole it because I'm editing the sheet that we put together. So
because I could
Closer is my pick. I can tell you, though, Greg's pick will be, he was the only one to put this one on the sheet, and I'm giving him internal shit for it. Greg, what is your top record of 1980?
Well, I wouldn't say this is my top record, but of the ones that we picked, and I saw that no one else picked it, so I'm like, I'm going there. And I went, I'm going to be the contrarian. That's right. And I went with Glass House's Billy Joel.
Friday night, I crashed your party. Saturday, I said I'm sorry. Sunday came and trashed me out again. I was only having fun. Wasn't hurt.
It's not so much that I think it's in and of itself as this brilliant record, but I think it's an interesting document as to where music was heading. Here you've got this sort of traditional pop guy, and all of a sudden there's this injection of new wave into his music. He was clearly hearing it in the clubs in New York. He was hearing it around, and it influenced what he was doing. And so when you look at the hits off that record and some of the other things off that record, I think to ignore it and pass it off as just bad, over-commercialized, I think you can't overlook the fact that New Wave was making it to the mainstream.
And I think in Greg's defense, which it's hard to come to your defense, but in your defense, there's other bands at the time doing this as well, like Tusk, I think, from Fleetwood Mac, is the same kind of Lindsey Buckingham going, what is this punk? What is this new wave thing? How can I incorporate it? I don't think we've quite got there yet, but Neil Young is going to do the same sort of thing. Maybe even Paul McCartney, I think Henry and I kind of found out.
All right, let's just, like, you don't like Billy Joel, like, in general, but you think this record...
I think this record is a document of where music was heading, and it was in the mainstream, and it was a huge hit. So, obviously, people were gravitating to the punk and the new wave, because it's all over this record, and I think there's some good songs, and they're not the main cuts. I'm thinking Sleeping with the Television On, You Were the One, All for Lena is way dramatic but totally 80s, and I love it. I mean, I just think it's a fun listen.
Well, I mean, he did win a Grammy. I mean, you know, people liked it. I don't know what to tell you.
I liked it in 1980. I really did.
Right.
I did. Okay.
He won a Grammy. He also won an AMA.
It's definitely not the coolest record. I'm not making that argument, but I think given that no one else picked it, I was like, no, we've got to highlight what it is and where it stands in its time. And I get it if people are like, it's over-commercialized crap. There's some validity.
I mean, I feel like one of Billy Joel, like, kind of his strong points is the fact, like, he's kind of a dweeb, but that's, like, his thing, and it works, I think. I mean, I don't listen to Billy Joel all the time, but I definitely like, a few Billy Joel songs. So it's fun stuff. I mean, it's kind of fluffy, but it's definitely good.
I also like that Billy Joel has retired.
Really?
He won't write any more songs. He doesn't even... It's weird to me because as a musician, it's, like, hard to turn it off. But it's like he's, like, turned it off and said, I'm not doing it anymore.
Do you want to hear more, Chris?
I mean,
that's the main reason I'm glad he's retired.
Thank you.
But also, I respect it.
Thank you, Billy Joel.
Yeah.
Thank you, Billy.
I thought he was just not writing any music with lyrics.
Hey, I heard something like that too.
Maybe that's
like he's only doing jazz or something.
You know, any article about Billy Joel, I'm just skimming it anyway. So
sounds like a Billy Joel thing to do.
Right. Still rock and roll to me.
All right, we're going to start round two, and Henry, you get the start.
Talk about Melted Face record by Peter Gabriel. That was my... how do you make decisions between great records like this?
You just do. You just did.
Melted Face by Peter Gabriel was amazing. Dense, artistic, adventurous, risk-taking stuff. What else can be said about it?
Well, for me, it's interesting to juxtapose it against the one that's coming, because to me, So might be, to me, the record of the 80s.
Like, well, yeah,
the 80s. But then for this record to be quietly, to me, so good, because going back when we rediscovered it,
yeah.
I was like, I always kind of, in the record collection, when I'm putting my finger on the Peter Gabriel records, I kind of just go to So all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So this one is really great. I think it's more adventurous, like you said. It's starting him down the road towards what he'll become in the 80s, but I think it's got a lot more going for it, just because it doesn't have hits. It's not, I think, celebrated as much as the other one.
Wasn't Games Without Frontiers kind of a hit?
I think so. Games Without Frontiers is kind of a hit.
What did you think of that one, Greg?
I love this record, and I just think about the songs like Family Snapshot and Through the Wire. That one stands out to me. It's just a great track, and it gave me the feels, as the kids say. I mean, I couldn't even tell you what it was, but I felt the emotion coming through on this record, even as a kid.
I think even since it was remastered, you can hear it in all of its glory now. So maybe it didn't sound that good in 1980 when the audio equipment wasn't as good, but I know today it sounds great. Megan, did you like that one?
Oh yeah, I like Peter Gabriel a lot, and actually after listening to this record and my surprise pick, which is Genesis, you know, their record, and I kind of got into them a little bit more, and for some reason I always thought that Peter Gabriel and Phil Collins had some sort of argument with each other or some falling out, but I was kind of surprised to learn that it was pretty amicable and yeah. You just never hear that. So I was like,
that same thing.
I was going to mention that as well, because it was really cool finding out that they were actually really good friends, and it was that dickhead keyboard guy that always wore the rugby shirts that was the asshole in the band. Mm-hmm. But Phil Collins actually helped Peter Gabriel come out with the gated drum sound for this record, and they were big friends, and I think it really opened things up. And of course, Phil Collins is known for that gated drum sound on In the Air Tonight, but he also helped Peter Gabriel with it on this, and I just thought that was really cool. And also the Behind the Music, or whatever they call that now, classic albums, where Peter Gabriel was talking about telling the people that were working on the drums with him that we weren't going to use cymbals, and how that restriction actually opened things up, because it created an artistic pathway by limiting, which I think is a neat idea, to limit yourself as opposed to being open to all possibilities and still trying to create under those conditions.
Like being right-handed and having to learn to write with your left.
Right.
You know?
Right. And see what you can do with the restriction.
Yeah.
Second top pick for 1980 is completely different than the Peter Gabriel Melted Face album. That's Gaucho by Steely Dan.
Mm-hmm.
This is also the opposite for me of the Billy Joel record. As a kid, I would have run screaming into the streets when my dad put Gaucho on, because my dad was a Steely Dan guy. But I feel
isn't every dad?
I know, right? And I think I'm coming into
the dad
age, so maybe that's what it is.
Comes out.
So this album to me is so ahead of its time. To me, what it's talking about is my generation right now. It's the disenfranchised, the fading hipster, the we're too cool for school, we don't care, the ambivalent, post-ironic person who's finally finding out that that's not working out anymore, and he's got actual problems, whether it be substance abuse or relationship problems. Every time I listen to it, I feel like it speaks more and more to what my generation now is going through. So I love it. I also love it because it's short for a Steely Dan record, even though I know there were a couple more tracks they were working on that they just couldn't get right and didn't put on the record. But for me, it's a perfect start to finish concept record. Nobody else wants to talk about it.
I don't mind
Megan, say why it's so great.
Okay, so hear me out.
I can't say anything.
I respect Steely Dan for, like, the musicianship and, like, all of that, but when I was listening to it, I just, maybe it's because I'm, like, a young woman, like, I just don't, like, I could not really get into it very much. Like, it just, it was too dad rock for me at this point in my life, but I respect it for what it is.
You're gonna love this record in 15 years, Megan. Trust me.
I'll dig it back up.
Hey, you know, you don't have to.
Yeah, I know, and I don't.
Some of us don't.
Well, Greg, I want to pass it back to you because I want to get off the hot seat. What is your second pick? 1980.
That's uncomfortable,
isn't it? We don't want to sit there in the hot seat.
Well, hey, I wasn't that mean.
Their silence.
We already, Chris and I already had it out over that record. We're done talking about it.
But, yeah, so my second pick was Wild Planet by B-52s. This record just, so there was a radio station when I was a kid growing up, and they played like all kinds of college rock, and it was everything from Pink Floyd to whatever. Yeah. And they would play the random tracks off this record. They didn't play whatever hits there might be. They played Dirty Back Road, and I guess Private Idaho was a hit. And so I was kind of curious at that point. So I went home, I bought this record, took it home, and I was like, this is just the wildest, wackiest stuff. And when you put it in the context of the band, you know, that first album, 79, they were sort of like, it was weird and from another planet, but from the future, but from the past. And it wasn't, but here they had really settled into what they were going to be. And I mean, songs, I mean, and I don't even like the big hits. I love Quiche Lorraine.
Isn't that the one that like everybody, do we talk about Quiche Lorraine?
Yeah, it's a song about a poodle.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just kooky. And the other song I really like is Strobe Light, because that's just fun and a little zany, and, you know, it's just a crazy track. And when you start to listen to it the first time, you're like, oh, okay, that's weird, but fun. And then you get into Private Idaho and Give Me Back My Man. It's another track they played on the radio that I listen to all the time. It's just different and strange and fun. And yes, I can listen to this record from start to finish just because it's just a really fun, lively, different. There's nothing else out there.
Yeah, like I even think back to when I first was exposed to them, like in the late 80s, being an REM nerd and going backwards to B-52s, how original and weird it sounded. Even, I guess it was almost a decade old at that point. I was just like, there's nothing like this being played even on college radio at
the time. Before the pod, I had not given this record a listen from beginning to end. I knew the hits from later, from Cosmic Things.
Didn't they do that with, we'll talk about it later, but Dawn Was, so it was kind of more, but it kind of smoothed out. I always thought that record was more smoothed out, B-52s, like reined in a little bit.
But I got to listen to the band with Keith Strickland, and his guitar playing is really good. The other guy, the drummer that picked up the guitar, did a good job of sort of approximating what Keith Strickland would do on his own, but it wasn't Keith Strickland. It's like he was pretending to play like him, but it wasn't quite there. I really liked listening to Keith Strickland on this one.
And I think it was,
Kate Pearson has a really good voice too. Like, I think she's kind of an underrated vocalist, but she did a song with Iggy Pop called Candy, I think. Mm-hmm. And I really, really like that song. And I've always liked her voice. And although like some of the B-52s, like their stuff is kind of silly, you know, when you think of like I fucking hate the song Rock Lobster just cause I've heard it so many times, but like their other stuff, it's like really, like you guys said, like pretty original, like even today, like there's really not a lot like that. I would say they were unique even in the new wave, you know, arena.
Absolutely. And
I had the name wrong, by the way, sorry about the guitar player. His name was Ricky Wilson. Keith Strickland was the drummer.
Urban Dweller was gonna get blown up this week for that.
Say,
sorry
everyone on the internet and around the world.
Yeah, Ricky Wilson.
I meant Ricky Wilson when I said that.
Ricky Wilson was Cindy Wilson's brother.
Right.
And so she's the other female singer. And this record. This was not his last record. It was.
It wasn't?
No. It was, there was another record after this one, and then he passed away.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
To wrap up our favorites, Megan, you're going to get last pick, and you get your chance to pay me back for stealing one of my favorite records with Closer.
So. This is such a good record. Scary Monsters and Super Creeps by David Bowie.
Damn,
this is first album after like the Berlin Trilogy, which I believe is Low, Heroes, and Lodger, pretty sure.
Yeah.
And this album, it's so hard to pick a favorite Bowie album because he has so many good records. And this was his 14th studio album, which is pretty crazy that he had already been around like that long and was already that established. And then he releases this record, which super like successful commercially and just really weird. Like, it's kind of the perfect balance of kind of that weird yet really commercial and really catchy. And there's just so many good songs on it. I mean, like Ashes to Ashes, the title track, Fashion, which actually John Lennon helped write, and we just talked about Double Fantasy. So it's kind of, you forget how much like John Lennon was still like around in the music scene in 1980. Because, you know, it kind of gets overshadowed by the fact that he died that year or two. So this is one of probably my favorite albums ever, not just of 1980 or of the 80s, but I absolutely love it.
Yeah, I do too. I like this one a lot. And I think this one was my first, because of the videos at that time, David Bowie was like the cool into the pool on MTV because there was only like 20 videos on there to begin with. But then to go and buy the record and then hear all that strange stuff as well on there that's not the hits, like for my young ears, it just blew me away that he could do both. And I guess this was my first real exposure to Bowie at the time, so it's always been my favorite, but I think it holds up with all of his stuff, which is saying a lot because of everything he's done. But yeah, this one might be one of my picks for the best for the decade as well, even though we're through only one year.
I mean,
of the 10.
I could have easily picked this one too, so.
It was a perfect way for him, I think, to start the decade. And I like that it was still a little weird because as he continued in the 80s, I think he obviously went with the even more commercial route. So, which, I mean, I don't mind that. But like this one, I like that it still has that weird kind of Bowie.
It's funny you should mention that because after we start, you know, as happened throughout this whole project, I would be listening to a record and sort of be in it for a good long time, and then I'd start looking at other records that this person did, right? And in Bowie's case, it did send me to, you know, the Let's Dance record and looking at that in detail. And there are some commonalities in the way that he related to music between the two, even though his methodology was a little different in places. It's so weird. It's like it's like on Let's Dance, he decided, okay, I'm going to do a pop record the way a pop record should be done.
And he
took the lessons he learned on Scary Monsters and applied it to an idiom, you know, that he thought would be successful. I don't even know if I'm explaining it right, but you understand what I'm saying, right?
We'll have plenty of time to talk about that one when we get to it. So those are all of our favorite records of 1980. Now we're going to talk real quick, because some of these are dumpster fires, about our least favorite albums of 1980. I'm going to start with my least favorite record.
Like of all time?
Maybe.
Of forever?
Maybe.
There were some true dogs that we had to listen to.
This one is called the Fame soundtrack.
Ooh.
Man, that one smells
This is why we came up with the new rule that we don't do soundtracks anymore. You said, we talked about it. You came in here and we said, fuck a soundtrack. This is not a real record anyway.
Is that Irene Cara?
Is that Irene Cara? Yeah.
Woof, man.
I'm also going to say this just for the record. Fame soundtrack somehow got 3 song snippets played on the episode, even though it's my least favorite record. I think we just kept trying to find something worth playing. But does anyone else want to comment on
that? Well, I mean, why did it suck so bad? What was wrong with it?
To me, it was
aged well at all.
Tell me why.
I just think it kind of, you can tell it's from the early 80s, like in the worst possible way. Like, it's just really cheesy. Like, okay, I had never listened to it before. Because, I had never seen Fame. Because is it a movie or a show?
It started as a movie, and then it became a television show.
Okay. Yes. I was kind of confused by that. And so maybe it's just because I wasn't, alive during that time. I just don't get it, but I didn't really like it. I mean, Irene Cara, obviously she has a good voice, but it was kind of a typical early 80s voice. I don't think there was really anything unique about it in any way.
I think the production was a typical, they were trying to go for what they thought the time sounded like too, which kind of sounded extra cheesy. Also, I have a big problem with Christian rock and musicals, because the music in both of those genres is not made for the sake of the music. It's made to serve a different purpose.
I take issue with that first part.
So, to me, a musical, these songs are made to tell a story that go along with a visual, not just be heard on their own, so that might take away from it. And one final bit of housekeeping, just to correct Henry the Old Man's memory.
What?
We banned Greatest Hits records, not soundtracks.
Oh, shit.
Damn. Know your shit.
Know your own show, dog.
Come on, man.
Greg, what's your least favorite? And this one is, this one,
I want to say
this one's so bad, it makes me mad.
It is really just aggravating.
It is aggravating, isn't it?
It is. Well, first of all, let me take issue with the fact that it's a greatest hits album, okay? That's not an album. That's a compilation. And I'm not interested in listening to somebody's, here are the best things I have. And if that's the best you've got...
It's his greatest hits for 20 years' work.
It's stupid. Now, what record are you speaking about?
Oh, yes. REO Speedwagons.
I thought it was one of those, the album that has no name that you won't say, that you don't want to speak.
It's no. Everyone should know and steer clear. And I think you said it best, Henry, when you said this is douchebags making douchebag music for other douchebags. That's it. That's really what it boils down to. And it's just awful. And maybe it's what they call in the radio industry burn, where it got played so much, it just got on your nerves. But I don't think I would have liked it anyway.
I don't like his voice at all.
Yeah, his voice is annoying. It's right up there with the... I just saw that. That's hit the list, so I'm not going to say. Megan, you actually put this record down as your worst, as well as Greg, just to double up on how shitty it is.
I hate, not only do I hate this record, I fucking hate REO Speedwagon. And I used to have a boss who, she loved REO Speedwagon, and her name was Karen, and she was in her 50s, which is probably a majority of REO Speedwagon fans.
Hi, Karen.
She probably isn't listening, but if she is, my stance has not changed. She would bring in this old boombox with an REO Speedwagon cassette, an attempt to try to convert me. So I heard this album all the time, and I hate it. I've never liked it, and his voice is just kind of irritating. The REO Speedwagon guy, whatever his fucking name is, it doesn't matter. I'm not gonna look it up.
Somebody called this record divorce rock or something like that.
Oh, that's perfect.
Yeah, was Karen a divorcee? That's what I need to know.
No, I don't think she was divorced. Mm. But
they said, if you were of a certain age, my mom or Chris's mom had this record in a drawer on cassette.
You know, though, in all seriousness, I kind of wanted to approach it from some level of, I wanted to find a way in. And that would have been interesting to me.
That was my...
Because I'd never actually heard that record except for the hit. I could not believe the level of awfulness that was on this record. I mean, I think it was the only... I think there were two records this whole year that I couldn't make it all the way through. I had to cut it. And the other one was the one that Henry is going to tell us about.
So you guys threw down hard on REO Speedwagon, those poor guys. who are just trying to make a living. Who, by the way,
they definitely did.
But they're rich. But
yeah, they made a living.
There was some serious payola going on. When I did research for that, I started seeing all this evidence at the time of them doing payola, and this was when the same record company was not pushing the Clash like they should have been. Why do you guys forget about why Lost in Love was so bad by Air Supply? That record was bad.
You know, I think it's so bad that I think it just leaves my memory.
It is the worst. Yeah, I would say it's worse than REO Speedwagon. It is the most middle of the road, like cringeworthy stuff. It made me uncomfortable to listen to. At least with REO Speedwagon, I could say, I could get into my head, this is dude shit.
I kind of wondered if they were maybe two sides of the same band, too.
Everything was crawling back up in me as, like, the worst.
I honestly totally forgot about this record, so I have nothing to say about it.
What do you mean you forgot
about
it?
That's probably the best thing you can say about it.
Completely forgot about it.
Just terrible. Yeah, I actually had two. I think I might hate it worse than REO Speedwagon.
We probably should have made the dog section a little bigger. I really wanted to throw down hard on why Triumph by the Jacksons was so bad.
Well, you know what's interesting? Maybe we'll do that for the next year, but it's kind of neat to throw down on records that are on their face supposed to be some of the best records of 1980. I know a lot of times on the show, Henry and I would both say, it's hard to tear this record apart because it's like, you know, it's supposedly a great record, but there were some on this list that were like,
dogs.
Yeah. Just bad news.
No offense to dogs.
Dogs, total dogs. All right, for our last category, I called it the Wow, That's Pretty Good pick of 1980. Greg, you get to start us off, and I have no idea what you're going to say.
Yeah, I was kind of a little bit taken by surprise by this
category. I thought you might have were going to say Air Supply because you went to scramble to your list a second ago, but maybe not.
I already stood up for Billy Joel. I can't stand for Billy Joel and Air Supply.
And Gaucho.
That's right. The record that that we actually reviewed was Get Happy, Elvis Costello.
Oh, yeah.
I'm a huge Elvis Costello fan. I like some of the earlier stuff a little bit better.
Yeah.
But Get Happy is still strong, and I like the quick poppy songs on that record. And but, yeah, I'm more of a My Aim Is True, This Year's Model guy. But Get Happy is a solid pick, and if you've gotten past the first wave of Elvis Costello, you kind of got the hits, you know, Get Happy. It's a solid record, and it's a lot of fun to listen to. It's just a 80s kind of punky, but still settled back into that pub rock kind of thing.
Yeah, and they definitely were admittedly like doing lots of speed and cocaine at the time, which contributed to this. To that amped up effect, which is kind of neat. But I'm like a next year's model guy as well. So it's one of those that is hard for me to pull out, especially with Armed Forces around too.
Right.
But then when you do pull it out, I'm always pleasantly surprised at how good it is. But it is hard when you're looking at records in a particular artist catalog and the artist is so good.
Right.
When you're looking at their third or fourth best record, you're like, oh, yeah, I forgot how much I like this one.
But it's so much better than REO Speedwagon.
It is. All you have to do on this year-end program is just name drop how shit REO Speedwagon is, and you'll be fine in your pick. Megan, what is your wow, that was pretty good pick for 1980?
So my pick is Duke by Genesis, which I had never really given Genesis that much of a chance. I kind of just viewed them a little bit like as kind of like Steely Dan, like kind of just like dad rock you know. But after listening more to Peter Gabriel and everything, obviously I kind of got led into the direction of Genesis. And I don't know, I just really like this album. I mean, the production of it is really good. I think it's aged really well. It's obviously, I think it was probably more commercial for them. Like, you can kind of tell a little bit the direction that they're going in, like Phil Collins especially. But I don't know, I was just surprised that I really liked the whole album. It was kind of, it wasn't super long. It was, I think, both sides, maybe like six songs on each side. So it was really easy to listen to. And yeah, I was surprised that I enjoyed it because I had never really given them a chance before.
I think that's an interesting point too, that kind of pumps up Steely Dan and Genesis for both me and Megan. Is it like both those bands have a reputation of these long, drawn-out things. Right. Mm-hmm. So when you hear a record by theirs, it's like, oh, that's not that long. That's pretty good.
Yeah, and maybe that's what I was expecting, because, like, I thought, you know, when you think of Steely Dan and you think of Genesis, you just think of, like, these really elaborate, you know, very talented musicians, but just, like, very drawn out. And this one, it was kind of short and sweet compared to what I was, like, expecting, I guess.
This is also a record that outside of the show, Henry and I, over the years, have texted each other when we discover a record or go back and find a record we really like, and we'll text the other one and be like, dude, check this out. And we've never really had big disagreements, but
Duke was not my favorite record. I think the keyboard sound threw me off and a whole lot of other things, but that's well documented on the show. I don't want to keep talking about it.
Well, Henry, why don't you tell us about your extra pick?
Surprise to me was the Fela Kuti record, ITT. I've never been a big fan of, I guess you call it world beat music or something like that. I didn't expect that I would find it as interesting as I did. And this is called Afrobeat music. And I expected it to be songs, right? Like several songs, but it wasn't. I just put it on as I was driving. It was like a trance. You know, it goes on, and I was like, well, this is as good as Spiritualized or anything like that. You could kind of ride it like hypnosis. And it was just this beautiful piece of art that just sort of been hidden for me, you know, and I could sort of finally feel the connection between this music and some of the other stuff that I'd listened to in my life, you know.
Yeah, and I'm drawing a blank right now, but there was another record we covered that I absolutely love that did kind of a world music sound, and you said you liked this one a lot better than that record, and I was kind of like taken aback by that, because I was like, how can Henry say that? But then I was like, well, yeah, this is the Fela Kuti record's really, really good. Okay. And I was kind of shocked too. I think my trouble entering into that world is, oh my God, this is a record with one song on it, so I can't really do this. But then I put it on, and I hate to even say it in a bad way, because I don't mean it in a bad way, but if you put it on and not just as background music, it's also great. It's like, you don't have to put all your energy into it and focus into it.
Right.
I really like it.
It's music you can live on. I don't know if that makes any sense. Live with, rather than pay close attention to and dissect courses and choruses and verses and somebody's voice. I think this is one of those songs where you can sort of feel between the notes, you know, in a weird way. So
my pick, right out of the gate, the first month of January 1980, you know, Henry and I talked about doing this show, and then we made the list, and then it got down to brass tacks that I had to listen to a Barbra Streisand record, and I was like, I don't want to do it. Maybe I can't. Maybe I'm not cut out for this show.
Can't see that we got a high.
not saying I'm a huge fan of this record. I'm just saying I was pleasantly surprised by how not awful it was.
Yep.
And I think that in and of itself got me off on the right foot to discover a bunch of stuff from 1980. Instead of just going through my own collection and going, this is what 1980 was, it really opened up. There was a bunch of stuff that I missed. And so, yeah, I think Guilty's not bad.
It's in fact, it's good.
I can't make myself say that word, but yes, it's not bad.
Well, I was, occasionally I look at podcast reviews for a show, right? And I've got a review from QWPDFG on April the 4th of 2019, who said, "Love it. These guys turned me on to Barbara Streisand."
That's actually my ghost handle. That was the only way I was able to express how I like this record. I have to confess.
I mean, I think that for what it is, it's definitely the best kind of right, like you can definitely still feel like the disco element of it, which I think a lot of early 80s music, there still was a lot of carryover of that, but the production is really good, and I mean she has a really great voice, so I was kind of surprised that I enjoyed the record as much as I did, because I don't know, like Barbara Streisand, I just never had really listened to her before.
I think it was less about Barbara and way more about Barry.
Absolutely. I agree. And I thought that was interesting, not knowing that.
Right. Yeah.
And also, I compared it to that Diana Ross record that we reviewed, thinking, well, she's going to get her ass kicked by Diana Ross trying to do disco dance music. And then, like, no.
Not quite.
No. No. Not when you got the Bee Gees on your side.
I was going to say, those guys and Barry Gibb, they were craftsmen, and they wrote those songs to fit their style, but make it work for Streisand.
Maybe the thing was is that she actually trusted Barry Gibb to do the thing. Diana Ross worked with the guy in
Le Chic.
Nile Rodgers?
No. Just Chic, not Le Chic.
Just Chic. Well, the guitar player is Nile Rodgers, right?
Yep.
But
and he's from the band Chic.
Chic, not Le Chic. Where am I getting Le Chic from?
From Le Freak, which is a song by Freak. Chic.
Le Chic. She didn't go with his mixes, right? She went in a different direction with it. Later on, they published the Nile Rodgers mixes, which I think were superior.
Yeah, I think you got to trust your guy if you're going to go down the road with him.
Yeah, if you're going to get a hired gun to keep you in the 80s, you know, or to modernize your sound, trust the guy to do what he does, you know.
Well, and he ended up working a lot with Madonna.
Yeah, and he worked with Cyndi Lauper and a lot of other like artists that needed a little bit of a punch up in the 80s. And his name always pops up in surprising, not really surprising places. Like he's worked with Daft Punk recently too. So the guy is really great.
One interesting point, and I know we got to close the show, Chris, but I wanted to say that there were some records that we listened to that we assumed we were going to like. Right, just on its face, just by reputation, right? And it turned out we didn't care for them so much, like that Ramones record that was so poorly produced by Phil Spector.
Yeah,
we didn't like that one. that Television Personalities record, we didn't care for that one.
Yeah, I think some of it too was so in our wheelhouse of what we always assume we like that we're like, ugh, let's hear some more Barbra Streisand and REO Speedwagon. <Yeah. laughs> To me, 1980 really did represent like a crossroads between that 70s thing kind of starting to fade away and the 80s new wave sound coming in. So I can't wait to get to 1981 and see what happens. So I do want to make a quick bid to say, we have made the list pretty much for what we're going to review in 1981, but it's always open to you, the listeners. So if you want to get in touch with us and help us pick some of the records, Henry is now going to tell you how you can do that.
Well, first of all, I want to thank Greg for showing up for us today. Thank you, Producer Greg. First time on the mic, back in a long time.
That's right.
Thank you very much. If you
thank
like
you.
The way that we sound, you can talk to him, an Urban Dweller on Instagram or Urban Dweller on Twitter. Let me spell it. URBNDWELLR, both on Instagram and Twitter. Is that right, Greg?
That's it.
And we're thankful to have him on the team. And also, thanks, Megan, our social media director, for showing up today. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
If you want to start a social media argument with us, you'll probably be arguing with her.
And she also does a segment on the show now regularly, so we're excited to actually have her live here instead of pre-recorded, so that's awesome, too.
Also, if you like our show or you like the records we're choosing, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. But you can also listen to us on Spotify and Stitcher and share it with your friends. You can chat us up on Twitter at 80sexposed, 80s Exposed, or 80smusicexposed@gmail.com. Our Instagram handle's kind of weird. It's 80s374, but they can find us if they search for 80s Music Exposed, right?
Yep.
Chris, guess what?
What's that?
I made you a mixtape.